told me, to say nothing of his shattered career. But we could figure that all out. He still wanted to be my husband. I knew that now. And I wanted to be his wife. Maybe that would be enough to give us a new start. We had rolled down the windows, allowing the sounds of the night to enter the car. There were not many of them. A lone car, somewhere else in the neighborhood. A few crickets chirping. That was really it. The quiet didn't last long. Maybe 3 minutes had passed when we heard automobile engines, lots of them, coming fast. 3 Stanton City police cars ripped past us, then a Stanton City police van. They were followed by 2 Virginia State Police vehicles, and several more from the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, and an unmarked car, a Subaru of all things. "What the..." Ben began. "Teddy," I said. The 4 of us vaulted out of the car. The police cars turned into Dansby's place. I broke into a jog toward his driveway. Then I heard the gunshot. It came from the direction of Dansby's house. "Teddy!" I shrieked and started sprinting. Why had I let Teddy go into such an obviously dangerous situation? What kind of big sister was I? I had allowed my own zealousness to put him in danger rather than letting good sense guide my actions. I reached the Dansby driveway and didn't stop, running up it with my arms pumping, heading toward the house. I could hear yelling coming from inside. The front door was wide open. There were cops crouched just inside with their guns drawn. More cops were outside, hiding behind their cars. Then I saw a blur, dashing away from the side of the house. It was Teddy, hurtling away from the house. There were suddenly a 6 guns trained on him. In the chaos, the cops didn't know whether he was friend or foe, and they weren't taking any chances. A chorus of shouts filled the night. "Hands up! Hands up! Stop right there!" "Don't shoot him!" I tried to bellow over the din. "He's my brother!" As if they knew who I was. Teddy thrust his hands up and fell to his knees. He was quickly swarmed by 3 officers who grabbed various parts of him and dragged him awkwardly behind one of their cars. "Teddy!" I screamed. "Teddy!" I ran toward him.
"Oh, God! Oh, God!"
he was saying. He was sobbing. I had seen my brother in all kinds of woeful states, as high and as low as you can ever witness another human being. I had never seen him this distraught. The words coming from him were so garbled by his hysteria I couldn't even make them out. Finally, between gasps, it became clearer.
"Help her! Please, God! Help her!"
"Sir, calm down," said one of the cops, who was kneeling next to him behind the patrol car. "Help who?"
"He shot her," my brother managed. "He shot her."
"Who shot her?" the cop asked.
"Dansby. He shot his wife. I was watching her in the living room. As soon as the patrol cars came up the driveway, he walked into the room and he shot her in the back of the head."
Teddy brought his hands to his face. He couldn't control himself.
"Her head, it..."
he said. And then he collapsed, vomiting on the driveway as he did so. I was now behind the car with him. "Teddy," I said. "It's me, Teddy." I put my hand on his back, for what little good that would do.
"Requesting emergency medical services," I heard the radio squawk. "We have a white female with a single GSW to the head. No breathing, no pulse."
"Copy that," the dispatch replied.
Then a new voice burst through the static.
"We're going to need a hostage negotiator in here. The suspect has barricaded himself in a room upstairs. He's taken an infant with him. He says he'll shoot the baby if anyone tries to come in."
Chapter 62. From the time she left the courtroom, It had taken Amy Kay about 40 minutes to figure it out. Longer than she might have liked, but still less time than an episode of Dancing with the Stars. She started with Dansby's fury over her decision to drop all charges against Melanie Barrick. He couched it in all the usual ways. It was bad for his re-election chances. What would the party think? They couldn't be soft on crime, etc. But it was still notable for its vehemence. She had never seen Dansby care that much about one of their cases. She thought about the evidence lockup. Who, besides sheriff's deputies, had access to it? Personnel from the Augusta County Commonwealth's Attorney's Office, of course. Then she thought about the fingerprint, and the fact that it wasn't in the database. Amy was in the database. So were the other prosecutors. Everyone connected with law enforcement eventually wound up in that database. Except for one man. Dapper Dansby, the guy who promenaded in front of the cameras every chance he got, but who never went to crime scenes and never dirtied his hands with the hard work of investigation. It also explained his Augusta County exclusivity. After all, who had preceded Aaron as Commonwealth's attorney? His father. Had the elder Dansby covered for his son? That remained an open question. The timeline of attacks certainly molded neatly into Dansby's biography. Those three hits in 2002-2003, Dansby was just finishing up high school. The sporadic hits from 2004 to 2010, he was off at college, then law school. Then in 2011, he returned home, and the rapes came in bunches. It all fit. Still, she had to be absolutely sure this time. Dansby had not returned to the office after the trial, allowing Amy to make an unfettered trip into the pages of Southern Living to grab a few items that would surely have his prints on them. She drove the things up to the sheriff's office, where Justin Herzog was happy to help. From his noxious-smelling nerve center, he was able to confirm that the fingerprints matched Person B and the Room 307 unsub. Amy guessed she'd eventually be able to get the state crime lab to confirm Dansby's DNA had also been found under Richard Cotery's fingernails. But from a legal standpoint, she already had everything she needed. She called Judge Robbins, who was three scotches into his evening, but still agreed to sign the arrest warrant for Aaron Dansby without hesitation.
"I never liked that little sumbitch," he slurred.
Then Amy took this neat package, the fingerprints, the warrant, to Jason Powers, who was playing the 19th hole when she found him. A smile spread across his face as she explained everything to him. He then called Stanton City Police Chief Jim Williams, who mobilized his critical incident response team. With assistance from Augusta County's CIRT, they quickly planned their strike on the Dansby residence. Ever since then, Amy had been more of a spectator than a participant, driving along and then watching from afar as a salad of badges and uniforms mixed together. Now and then, she received updates, including that Dansby had barricaded himself in the house with an infant, of all things. She had received her most recent briefing. Negotiations had apparently stalled when she wandered past a patrol car. Amy had hung back and not gotten involved as they did their jobs. Then she passed a patrol car and recognized Melanie Barrick sitting inside. "What's she doing here?" Amy asked one of the deputies.
"Supposedly that's her kid inside," he said. "She tried to get into the house. Took four officers to restrain her. We didn't know what else to do with her, so..."
He nodded toward the car, where Melanie Barrick was handcuffed to the back seat. Her kid. Of course it was. The child who had been removed from his mother's care shortly after the raid. That was Dansby's son. That's why Dansby had Richard Coterie plant those stolen drugs in the first place. He needed Melanie Barrick to be framed with something serious enough she'd never get the boy back. How had Dansby managed to convince social services to give him the baby? It couldn't have been difficult. The Dogwood Road address and the Dansby pedigree were more than enough. How long has she been in there? Amy asked.
Don't know. Little while now.
They paused the conversation, out of respect for the dead, as the sheet-draped form of Claire Dansby was carried out to an ambulance. Then Amy asked to be let into the patrol car. At the very least, Melanie Barrick deserved some company. "Hi there," Amy said softly as she slid into the seat next to Melanie.
"What's happening?" Barrick demanded.
"Aaron has locked himself in the room. He has your son with him. The hostage negotiator is on the other side of the door. Aaron has made it very clear he'll hurt your son if anyone tries to come in."
"But is he making demands, or—"
"I don't know. They haven't let me in the house. From what I understand, they're just talking. I don't know if he's asked for anything specific."
"So how does this end?"
"We don't know. We have snipers in place, and the CIRT team is ready to roll. But those are last resort options. For now, we just have to be patient. Everyone is prioritizing getting your baby out of there alive." Barrick just looked up toward the house.
"Sorry about the, Amy said, nodding at Barrick's tethers.
"Yeah," she said. "Me too."
"And I'm also sorry I didn't figure this out sooner."
"Took me a while, too. Can't blame you." They both stared up at the house for a long moment.
"Has he fathered other children?" Barrick asked.
"Not that I know of in Augusta County," Amy said. "Then again, until a few moments ago, I didn't even know about your son."
That Aaron Dansby might have other children, a strange extended family, united by a father's brutality, was something neither woman could even consider at the moment. Soon, a mostly bald man wearing dark body armor approached the patrol car. Amy felt herself recoiling. Had something happened? Was this it? The news that would haunt Amy forever and positively shatter the woman next to her? The man introduced himself as Stanton City Police Officer Matt Ezell and explained he was a trained hostage negotiator. Accurately reading the stricken looks on the women's faces, he began with the news they most needed to hear.
"The baby is fine," he said.
"Thank God,"
Melanie said, putting her hand over her heart.
"We've been talking with Dansby intermittently. Sometimes he answers us, sometimes he doesn't. We're not getting much out of him, to be honest."
"So what does he want?" Amy asked.
"That's why I'm here,"
Ezell said, then peered intently at Melanie Barrick.
"He wants you. He says he won't talk to anyone else."
Chapter 63. They couldn't guarantee my safety. Ezell must have told me that at least 4 times during a monologue about how anything could happen up there, how Dansby had already killed one woman and might be trying to lure me close so he could kill another. I didn't care. Alex was in danger. That bested any argument he might make. Once I finally convinced him I wouldn't be deterred, he had me uncuffed and led me up to the house. The officers who had previously prevented my charge inside were now parting for me like the Red Sea, starch-limbed and grim-faced. As I entered the front door, I looked to my left. The couch and rug, once neutral shades of off-white, were now splattered with blood. The acrid odor of gunpowder hung in the air. So what do I do, exactly? I asked, pausing at the bottom of the stairs.
Just get him talking, Ezel said. Obviously, the end goal is for him to surrender peacefully.
No, I said, that's your end goal. My goal is to get my son back. I didn't give a damn about doing it peacefully.
Call him Aaron,
Ezel continued.
That will make him feel more familiar with you. Once you get him talking, you want to keep him talking. If he's talking, he's not shooting anyone. You're trying to build a rapport with him. You want him to think you're his friend and that you like him. That'll make him more likely to surrender.
Somehow, I didn't think surrender was as much on Dansby's mind as it was on Ezel's. Amy Kay wasn't far behind me. I turned to her before I started climbing the stairs. If anything happens to me, please make sure Alex goes to Ben, I said. Ben is his father. Those are my wishes. Is that clear?
Yes, Amy said.
You promise?
I promise.
Thank you, I said. Then I started up. The Dansby staircase had a turn in it. I was soon on the second level hallway. It was lined with men in thick body armor and helmets, crouched behind plastic shields.
He's straight ahead,
Ezel said. I walked to the door and knocked. Aaron, I said in the calmest tone I could muster. This is Melanie Barrick.
Good. Are you alone?
No, there are officers up here with me.
Still? Jesus,
he fumed.
Tell them to go the hell away.
We'll do that if you hand over the baby,
Ezel said.
Not a chance, Dansby snapped. And I'm not talking to you anymore. I told you that.
Ezel and I exchanged glances.
Ask him what he wants,
Ezel said in a low voice.
What do you want, Aaron?
I asked.
I want to talk to you, alone, without those armed goons ready to storm the door the moment I open it for you.
I talk to you alone.
That's how this goes.
Alex began crying. It was a sound that reached down into that core of me, the piece of me that was Alex Barrick's mother and nothing else, and set a fire going. I'll go in, I said to Ezel. Please just clear out your men. He was shaking his head, but I pressed on. Look, Alex and I, we're a package deal. If he's got Alex, he might as well have me. I'd rather be in danger but with my baby than safe out here with you.
Yes, I realize that, but I can't.
Please, I said, putting my hand gently on his arm. Please let me do this. Then, from inside the room,
Do it, Ezel! Clear your men out and let her in! I can't do that, Aaron!
Ezel shouted back.
I can't give you another hostage! Your job is to save lives, Dansby said back. You forget. I've seen your training. You have to prioritize lives above everything. And I'm going to make this decision real easy on you. You either clear your men out and let Melanie in here, or I'm shooting this baby. And I'm giving you exactly 10 seconds to make up your mind. 10?
I surged toward the door and threw my weight against it.
No, Aaron, please! I shrieked.
9? He responded. I was already crying hysterically as I grabbed the doorknob, trying to shake it loose.
8, he said.
I pounded down on the knob with 2 fists, using my hands like a fireman's axe. I struck so hard, the pain radiated up my arms, all the way to my shoulders. The knob didn't give. I screamed, banshee-like.
7, he said.
Alex was crying harder. Was Dansby hurting him somehow? It made me even crazier.
I kicked the door, but the lock held. "Please, God, do something! Do something!" I roared at Ezel.
"Six," Dansby said.
I backed up as many steps as the narrow hallway would allow, then flung myself at the door with everything I had. It didn't budge.
"Five," Dansby said.
Forget the door. I ran up to Ezel and grabbed him by the shoulders.
"Four."
"Please, please," I wailed. Ezel's eyes were darting from the door to his men. Was he thinking about ordering them to charge? Wasn't it too late for that? I couldn't tell what was going on in that bald head of his.
"Three."
I started pounding on Ezel's armored chest, pleading in broken, nonsensical globs of semi-sentences.
"Two."
And then,
"Okay, okay, you win, Aaron,"
Ezel shouted.
"Stop the count. Stop it right now. We're going. Melanie is coming in. Just give us a moment here."
I stopped pounding Ezel. My hands were throbbing. I was bawling and hyperventilating simultaneously. Ezel was directing his men's retreat down the stairs. I was trying to steady myself. I had to keep my senses about me. Alex needed me. At least he had stopped crying. I'm not sure I could have gathered my wits otherwise. "They're going," I said in the direction of the door, my voice cracking. "They're going. Just don't hurt him." My breathing was still too fast. Ezel came back to my side.
"You all right?" he asked. "God, this is a disaster."
"Disaster," I said between gasps, "is always closer than you know." He looked at me quizzically, holding the glance long enough that I could see doubt, regret, and 100 other emotions telling him this was a terrible idea. "Just get the hell out of here," I said.
"All right," he said,
giving my arm one last squeeze.
"Good luck."
He walked briskly away, then made the turn down the stairs. Once he was on the first floor, he hollered up,
"Okay, Dansby, we've moved out. But if I hear a gunshot, all bets are off. We will come up there and we won't be talking anymore. Is that clear?"
There was no answer from inside the bedroom. I went up to the door and tapped it lightly. "It's me," I said. "And I'm all alone."
"Are you armed?"
"No."
"You better not be. If anyone comes into this room with a gun, I'm shooting this baby first and asking questions later."
"I swear to you, I don't have a gun." There was a pause.
"Okay," he said. "You can come in. The door is now unlocked."
A large breath leaked out of my lungs. Even my wildest nightmares couldn't have concocted a scenario like this. I was all alone, going back into a room with the man who raped me. He was armed, and all I had for protection were my own desperate prayers. Slowly, I turned the knob and pushed through the door into the room. The bulbs in the ceiling fan were illuminated, casting a harsh white light on everything below. There was a dresser immediately to my left at an odd angle, like it had been used as part of Dansby's defensive fortifications, but had been shoved out of the way so I could enter. Halfway across the room, an armoire had been moved so it was perpendicular to the entrance of what was either a large walk-in closet or a master bathroom. A mattress was leaning against one of the windows. A box spring was against the other. Neither Dansby nor Alex were anywhere within sight.
Close the door, Dansby said from the other room. I want to hear it close.
Okay, I said, shutting the door forcefully enough it made a noise.
Now lock it,
I did as instructed.
It's locked.
Hold your hands out in front of you. I have to be able to see them.
Okay, I said, palms extended.
For a brief moment, his head flashed from the other side of the armoire, like he was some kind of frightened forest creature. It went back just as quickly. Then he walked out. He had Alex tight against his body, facing outward, and a gun to Alex's tiny temple. The sight of it, my small, helpless baby with that ugly black pistol next to his head, nearly made me pass out. I had to lean against the dresser for support.
Oh, God, please, Aaron, no, I said.
Don't move, he said.
I'm not going anywhere. Can you please stop pointing the gun at Alex? He's your son, for God's sake. Your son.
I know that, he said. Keep your hands up. I held them a little higher for his inspection. Lift your dress, he said.
What?
I want to see if you have a weapon under there. Do it slow. Real slow.
I reached down for the hem of my dress, gathered it in both hands, then brought it up to my waist.
All the way up, he ordered.
It's belted. It won't go any further, I said.
Fine, he said. Put it back down, but keep your hands up.
As I followed my orders, I studied Alex more closely. It had been a month since I had seen him. His face had fleshed out. His head seemed to have become more symmetrical. But really, he hadn't changed as much as I might have thought. He had the same eyes. His father's eyes. But his eyes, too.
He was still my baby. My beautiful, beautiful baby.
Can I hold him? I asked.
No, Dansby said.
He was swaying back and forth to keep Alex soothed, a bizarre gesture considering he had a gun trained on the child. Alex had a slick of drool coming out of his mouth. His hands were perched on Dansby's arm, his tiny fingers splayed out for support. If he knew his mother had just entered the room, he gave no indication of it. Did he remember me? Or was there no place in his still-forming circuitry for someone he hadn't seen in more than a month? I chased away the thought and focused on Dansby.
Okay. So I'm here, I said.
You've got a gun. I don't, but a lot of guys downstairs do. What happens now?
We talk, he said.
About what?
About whatever, he said. I always wanted to talk to one of my women. You in particular. I've thought about you a lot. You may find this hard to believe, but I've probably thought about you over the last year more than you've thought about me. I really do care about you. I wasn't interested in any of this. I didn't want him caring about me, thinking about me, any of it. I didn't want to be in the same room as him. I didn't want to be in the same universe. But Ezel's instructions, keep him talking, build a rapport with him, came back to me.
If you care about me so much, why did you rape me? I asked. Why rape any of us?
Good question. Why? I've asked myself that same question a lot of times.
So what's the answer?
I don't know. I had to.
That's bullshit, I said. You made a choice every time you entered another woman's bedroom and forced her to have sex with you.
I know. I don't mean I was compelled by dark voices or anything. I'm only really alive during my encounters with women like you. We told people my wife, Claire, couldn't have babies. But the fact is, I'm impotent with her. With every woman I've ever dated, actually. I can only ever perform with a woman if I've broken into her house. That's the only thing that excites me enough. I've never had a problem performing with any of you, as you know.
He allowed himself a sick smile before continuing.
Claire knew I had a sexual problem, obviously. She was willing to do anything. We even tried having her role-play rape fantasies for me. It didn't work. My equipment always knew the difference.
So did your wife know about what you did?
No, he said, scoffing. Claire? Oh, God, no. She thought I suffered from frequent insomnia and that driving to the park and going for a walk helped me. I, quote-unquote, drove to the park at least twice a week. All the while I was looking for my next encounter. She never had a clue.
Couldn't you have tried, I don't know, therapy or something?
Are you kidding me? He snorted. I'm a Dansby. You think Senator Dansby ever had therapy? Or Congressman Dansby? Or Governor Dansby?
I couldn't listen to much more of this nonsense.
Well, you'll get plenty of therapy now, I said. What do you mean?
I mean in prison, Aaron. You understand this is over, right? Those men downstairs, they're not going to let you just walk out of here. You might as well surrender. Give me Alex and let's do this without anyone getting hurt.
No, he said. No, that's not how this is going to end.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is, Aaron. Just put down your gun, give Alex to me, and then walk out with your hands up. Let me raise our son the best way possible. He's your flesh and blood. Give him that chance. I bet if you surrender now, they'll send you somewhere around here. Your family could surely arrange that. We'll come visit you, Alex and I.
That was a lie, of course. And it may have been too thick of one, because Dansby's eyes, which had been trained on a piece of the floor, flared up at me, filling with anger.
You think I believe that? He said, gripping the gun tighter. You think I'm that stupid?
No, I said weakly. No, I'm serious. Alex he's going to want to know who his father is. It would be up to him, of course, but we would absolutely visit you if he was interested.
You're lying to me right now, he said, his volume growing. Don't lie to me. Not you.
Come on, Aaron. You have to think about what's best for Alex.
I am, he insisted. That's what this is all about. That's why I wanted you here.
He was shaking his head. His teeth were grinding together.
It's just a real shame Alex won't grow up with two parents, he said. I wanted that for him.
He removed the gun from Alex's head and stretched it out toward me. I was now staring at the black circle of its barrel from perhaps 10 feet away. He was breathing hard and his hand was shaking, but I didn't think he could miss from that distance.
I braced myself, keeping my eyes on his trigger finger. I wasn't going to stand there and let him shoot me. I wasn't there to martyr myself. The moment he began squeezing, I would dive behind the dresser. I just couldn't make my move too soon. "Aaron, please," I said, hoping to at least bargain for time.
"I'm sorry. I'm really, really sorry," he whispered.
And then, in one fluid movement, he tilted his head back, stuck the gun under his chin, and pulled the trigger. Chapter 64. The noise was deafening. A bright red spray burst from the top of his head and onto the wall behind him. "Alex!" I screamed. I rushed forward and grabbed him just as he began sliding from his father's dying grasp. The sound had terrified him, and his mouth opened wide in a cry. From downstairs, men were shouting. I could already hear feet thundering up the stairs. "We're okay," I shouted. "The baby and I are okay. He shot himself. Dansby shot himself." The last thing I wanted was for them to storm in with their fingers restless against their triggers. I opened the door just as they were about to break it down. "Are you all right, ma'am?" a guy with a shield asked. "Yes, yes, I'm fine. I have to get away from that," I said. I jerked my thumb in Dansby's direction, but didn't turn. I had no desire to see what he looked like as his life ebbed away. There were already enough horrible images of him in my head. Maybe this would change, but I felt no immediate satisfaction or closure in his death. There was a hollow place in me where Aaron Dansby was concerned. Revenge wasn't going to fill it. I already knew the emotions, while still too new to figure out precisely, would be more complicated than that. At that moment, all I really wanted was to take care of my son. Alex was crying. The gunfire had scared him. So had the yelling. I had to get him away from the carnage. I carried him downstairs, where a multitude of people with badges asked me if I was injured, if I needed assistance, if I had wounds that required treatment. "I'm fine. I just want to get out of here," I kept saying, cradling Alex protectively in my arms. Finally, I was out of the house. I didn't see Ben or Teddy or really anyone. The night was still being cleaved by flashing lights, blinding me. "Miss Barrick, over here, please," I heard a woman say. Not knowing who was calling for me or where exactly she wanted me to go, I followed the sound of the voice. It led me near an ambulance, where I was greeted by a woman with square-framed glasses and a tight ponytail. Tina Anderson, the family services specialist. "Miss Barrick, are you okay?"
"I'm fine.
We're fine," I said, clutching Alex tighter. "The EMTs need to examine your son."
"No," I said. "No exams. No EMTs. He doesn't have a scratch on him. He never has."
Alex cried harder. His scalp was getting red from the exertion. Anderson reached for him with covetous hands.
"Miss Barrick, your son is legally in the custody of Shenandoah Valley Social Services," she said. "I'm ordering you to turn him over right now."
"No," I said, shielding Alex with my body. "Leave us alone. Just leave us."
"Tina, I don't think we need to press the issue," someone said.
It was a woman's voice, deep and commanding. Nancy Dement, the director. She emerged from the darkness and slid next to her colleague, gently putting a hand on her back.
"I've been talking with Amy Kay from the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. I'll catch you up later, she said, then turned to me. We're dropping our abuse case against you, Ms. Barrick. Why don't you and your son go home and get a good night's sleep, and we'll see you in court tomorrow, when we'll make it official. My gratitude was so immense, I couldn't even stammer out a full sentence. Thank you, I said. Thank you. The system had a soul after all. Alex chose that moment to renew his complaints at an even greater volume. I think there's just too much stimulus for him out here. Is there somewhere quiet we can go? I asked, looking around for a place where it would just be the two of us. Nancy Dement found one before I did.
There's no one in the ambulance right now, she said.
Great, I said. Thank you. I climbed into the back of the truck, and Dement shut the door behind me. The sensory overload from the street, all that law enforcement light and clatter, faded away. Alex stopped hollering almost instantly. There was a small jump seat at the front of the cabin. I got us settled into it, nestling Alex in the crook of my arm. I was still shushing him, even though he had quieted. In the dimness, his big blue-gray eyes were searching around for something to land on. He glanced my way once or twice, but he mostly seemed transfixed by the roof of the ambulance, the walls, anything but the odd person holding him. I realized I was holding my breath. Here we were, reunited at last. It was the moment I had longed for. Anticipating it had sustained me through the worst of what I had experienced. But was this reunion meaningful only to me? Was I just another pair of warm arms to this child? Had our time apart made me a stranger to my own son? Finally, his gaze locked on me. He studied me blankly, with nothing in his stare betraying his thoughts. Then, slowly, this sly expression began forming around his mouth, like he had already figured things out but didn't want to let on. It spread next to his cheeks. At last, he couldn't hold back any longer. This huge, toothless grin had broken out across his face. I swear, even if dementia wipes every last memory from my mind many decades from now, I'll never forget that smile. It's because it won't actually be stored in my brain. It will be in my heart, along with the most important parts of both of us. There's my boy, I purred. He smiled even broader. That's right, I said, my eyes blurring with tears. I'm your mama. You remember me? I'm your mama. Of course he did. He was a child forged in a crucible of terror, born under uncertain circumstances to a poor mother whose own parents had abandoned her. But he didn't know anything about that. He didn't need to know. Babies are nothing if not a chance for the world to start over again. All that really mattered to him was that a connection had formed between us. It began as flesh, at the moment of conception, but had become so much more, growing stronger and more profound, just as he had grown from a tiny seed into the astonishing creature who was now cooing happily in my grasp. Through everything that had transpired, that mother-son bond had not been broken. I knew now it never would be.
This is Emily Rankin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Closer Than You Know by Brad Parks. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Mac Enterprises, Inc. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.